Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, the town that Musk built, how the eccentric trillionaire is now in real estate. With the news that Ford is scaling back its AI in favour of a human workforce, we ask if we should be better at AI by now. Plus, renowned global and political economist Mark Blythe talks about his book Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I want to start off this week by explaining to you the term economic hegemony. So we all know that the US is the largest economy in the world and China is nipping away at its heels as it grows in trading and innovation relevance. So economic hegemony is the predominance of a single state or institution or corporation in the global economy. And that means that it allows it to dictate market rules, control international trade and shape monetary policy. Now, that mature wisdom, though, would say that this dominance relies on having global financial might, technological innovation and productive efficiency. So the argument is growing that while the US has economic hegemony now, China is building its capability in every way that matters. So the next time you hear that term, you'll know what underpins it. Now, artificial intelligence has been sold as a technology that will transform productivity, cut costs and replace routine work. We often discuss it here on Taking Stock. And businesses across almost every sector are investing billions in AI, hoping to gain a competitive advantage. But behind the headlines, sometimes we do find that a different story is emerging. Companies are discovering that AI can make expensive mistakes, struggle with complex judgment calls and often need experienced human workers to guide it. Indeed, this week, Ford revealed it had rehired hundreds of veteran engineers after finding that its AI-driven quality systems couldn't match decades of human expertise. So are businesses falling into the trap of treating AI as a replacement for people rather than a tool to support them? Or are we entering a more realistic phase of AI adoption? We're joined now by technology journalist and author Chris Stokel-Walker. Chris, first off, do you think we're heading into the trough of disillusionment with AI?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Susan, and one that I think is worth looking at. So obviously that comes from the Gartner hype cycle, where we often see this with technology. I think maybe less disillusionment and more just rational thinking about where the strengths and the weaknesses of AI lie, because so far we've been very excitable in the last almost 4 years since ChatGPT was unleashed on the world. I think now we're starting to see some slightly colder, more calculating decisions on where actually this is useful, and maybe some admissions of mistakes where it really wasn't.
Where it really wasn't?
Yeah, that is, I think, the case in this instance. So you see perhaps some people getting overexcited, as we saw with Ford, where they're integrating AI through robots and thinking this is the answer. Now, generally in industrial areas, robotics, that is done by the cold calculus of just simply decision making. When you start to layer AI into that, generally what you have is humanoid robots. And humanoid robots, they look nice. They're pretty good in one way because they need to be designed like that so that humans can then rejoin the workforce with these machines. But actually, for some of this stuff, in like making cars, we've had, you know, now what, 1920 was basically when we started to see mass automation of motor vehicles. We obviously had Henry Ford a little bit before that. The machinery of making these things has existed for a long while, and it's been pretty good. So replacing that with these sort of more humanoid robots, I think, might have been one of those mistakes.
But in their case, I'm going to read out a quote from the vice president of vehicle hardware engineering. He said, "Mistakenly, we thought that by just introducing artificial intelligence and ingesting the design requirements we had, that would produce a high quality product." Is that not incredibly naive, Chris?
Yeah, and it's why it's quite so surprising to come from a company like Ford. But I think that what's happened, Susan, is that AI companies have sold this as the silver bullet, the thing that you really don't even need to think about. You know, AI is considered as a sort of outsourcing of all of the thinking that you have to do. And frankly, the companies themselves have been pretty convincing in their motivations and their PR behind this. So it's understandable that lots of people are thinking, well, actually, this is the God-given gift that replaces all of my human workers. But the reality is that a lot of it is hype. So it's not that AI can't be used. It's not even necessary that AI shouldn't be used. It's just we should be a little bit more honest in the ways that it can be used. And that often doesn't chime with what exactly these companies are saying.
I wonder, are you letting the executives off a little bit there, Chris? Because, I mean, isn't this what the job of people who are leading companies is, to be critically analytical anyway? Whether it is of AI or otherwise, isn't their job to think, look at improvements that can happen, namely innovation, then making calculated choices about whether they go after it or not, but then testing it and learning it before throwing the kitchen sink at it?
Yeah, but it's not me to judge, Susan. It's the shareholders of Ford who have dropped the price of the stock by 17.5% in the last month or so. I mean, look, we know that this is a mistake. We know, unfortunately, that sometimes the titans of industry, the people at the top of the boards, they pretend to be very smart and very good at what they do, but actually, you know, they often just swallow a lot of hype here. And I think, unfortunately, people in C-suite, they might well have done that, because truthfully, it's difficult to advise companies on this sort of stuff because it is so new. So even chief information security officers, chief technology officers, the people who you'd expect to be really conversant in this sort of stuff, they're not always like that because they don't fully know what exactly is going on. These things are moving so fast that it can be difficult to keep track of what's coming around the corner.
Well, since I have the chance to ask an expert in this area, I am going to take it, Chris, in your case and ask, how do we know, we being businesses, how do we know when we're doing this right, even the starting point? Because I often hear people talking about, well, what tools should I use as distinct to, like, what problem should I solve? What do you think the right way forward is? And to extend that, how do you know if you're being successful in doing so?
Yeah, so the two things that you said there, you said two sentences. What tool should we use and what problem should we solve? Well, really, you shouldn't be thinking about the first before you think about the second. And that is one of the issues that I think we've had with this adoption of AI in the last year or two in particular. As businesses started to realize that there was a race going on, they got very excited and also very worried at the same time about competitors starting to leave them in the dust. They just basically grabbed whatever they could, and they didn't think about how to actually apply the AI within their businesses, within their organization, for the best possible effects. You know, think about it this way. You wouldn't just buy a load of computers because you've been told that you need to buy computers, right? That's one way to just bankrupt your company, or buy a load of cars on the company card because you've been told that cars are really good. You would think about the need that you had for them. You'd make a decision, make a value judgment, go, well, what's the cost-benefit analysis here? Where will I really use this? And what can I expect to get from it? And then make your decision. What's happened here?
As I sit here talking to you in July 2026 and you talk about that cost-benefit analysis, I wonder about the benefits, not in terms of whether they're there, but whether we're judging the right ones. And the reason I'm asking you this is, I looked at the McKinsey State of AI before coming in to talk to you, and there was a statement in it that I was quite shocked by, actually, that the use of AI has not yet significantly affected enterprise-wide EBIT, which is earnings before interest and tax. Do you think that might be because at the moment companies are investing so much in AI, they're not seeing the returns being generated because we're early? Or is the cost of this and the benefit of this a little bit neck and neck and we're not really moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest. I think it's that we're too early, and we're too early, which means that we haven't really had it adopted across an entire enterprise. A lot of the stuff that we're seeing is ad hoc adoption, really. It's kind of individuals or individual teams, not even an entire company or department, choosing to try and adopt this and thinking, well, let's see what happens, rather than a much more structured use of this sort of technology. At the same time, the price of AI is going up. So a lot of people bought into this, said, let's buy our employees a Claude subscription. And then suddenly they found, when you have the latest cutting edge model, we've got Fable that was released this week, or I should say re-released, because it was initially released around about a week and a bit ago, then got slapped with an export ban, and finally Anthropic, the company behind it, has agreed with the Donald Trump government that they can actually put this out to the public, the price of that has gone up significantly. It is way more expensive than the previous generation of models. So I think probably part of the reason why we haven't seen that impact on earnings is that people are spending a lot of money, but also that the adoption of it has been very much scattergun at the minute, and we still need time for it to settle down.
In that report, I also saw this statement that I think would lead the world to perhaps be more sympathetic towards Ford, and it is this: high performers tend to pursue a bold agenda driven by innovation and transformation. In fact, learning may be the true pathway to high performance. In other words, companies like Ford are learning the hard way. The rest of us can lean on those learnings and learn the easier way. And therefore, rather than be critical of those who are making mistakes, we should be applauding their innovation and making sure that we can learn as a result of what they've done. Do you think, is that the way we will look at things in the next couple of months and years? Because this story is unlikely to be isolated.
No, I think that's the real reality of it, is that actually people need to learn from both mistakes and from successes. At the minute, what we're seeing is an awful lot of mistakes, missteps, and then retrenchments, and going, actually, this didn't work, we'll just scrap it, or we'll move on to another area, or something like that. You know, the one thing that I think we are missing at the minute is that kind of positive evidence of where AI is really making a difference. And you know, partly that might just be because those who are seeing a benefit, and I think that there are some of those who are, they're keeping their cards close to their chest because they realise this is a competitive advantage at the minute. But also, I think it's just that people haven't thought it through. Too many of those people, they're putting the cart before the horse. They're thinking, what AI shall we use rather than where shall we apply it and to what purpose?
I also wonder if the benefits, to go back to that word again, are actually concentrated in efficiency, productivity, cost reduction in by virtue of the fact that it takes you less time to do more things. As distinct to revenue generation, anecdotally, I'm hearing far more companies talk about how they're using it to manage their existing operations rather than come up with new ideas or certainly new revenue streams. What's your anecdotal experience?
I think a lot of people leading companies believe that this is the way that they can cut staffing costs, the way that they can cut corners, the way that they can become more efficient. And I think, ironically, what's happening at the minute is they're becoming less efficient because there's more stuff to manage. When you layer in a new element of technology like AI to your business, you know, there's a lot of effort that goes into that. And actually, sometimes people don't realize that. They think that this is just the panacea, that you just let it go and it starts to work and it becomes brilliant and everything is hunky-dory. But the reality is there's quite a lot of, you know, testing, checking, ensuring things are all okay that needs to go into that. And truthfully, I think that is why we're not seeing the kind of new revenue generation stuff, because people have their hands full at the minute trying to figure out just how to make this thing work within their organisations.
Chris, I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying there. And when you say about cutting corners and then following it up quickly with productivity, am I right in thinking that your interpretation is that companies aren't being fully thorough in their decision making, or that it's a fast grab to get extra an incremental profit? Is that what you're saying as regards cutting corners, as distinct to here's a great way to increase efficiency and we'll do it well?
Well, I think that it's that they just think it's a great way to increase efficiency and they don't think about whether they're going to do it well or not. I think a lot of people leading organizations, they've seen the data around AI, they've seen the forecasts of the International Monetary Fund saying 40% of jobs worldwide will be affected. And they've not really looked at what the word affected means. They just assume that suddenly they can cut their workforce by 40%. That's not the reality of what it is, actually. Those jobs, many of them will probably stay. They'll just look a little bit different. And it'll be AI as a co-pilot rather than putting AI on autopilot. So that's what I mean there in terms of that, Susan, really. It's less that they think that this is going to cut corners and become a massive moneymaker for them. More that it allows them to eke out bits of their wage bill that actually probably won't happen.
Well, far be it for me to question the IMF, but I'm going to do it anyway. I can't believe that it's only 40% of jobs will be affected. Like, would it not be closer to 80, 90, 100% of jobs being affected by AI? Affected,
yeah.
Doesn't mean gone, as you say, just affected.
Yeah, I think it depends on the level of AI and the ability that we get to in terms of what's called embodied AI, which is sticking this kind of generative AI systems that we have at the minute into either humanoid robots or other types of robots, actually the kind of physical elements of this. Because, you know, look, the economy is a big and wonderful place, and we have an awful lot of different jobs. So service jobs, customer facing jobs, all of those sorts of things you can imagine can be relatively easily automated with generative AI, with chatbots, with other tools like it. That's the kind of thinky stuff. But the doy stuff, the idea of, you know, having a robot kneel down under your toilet, figure out where in the waste pipe there is the issue, you know, bolting that nut onto it and ensuring that that is a secure, tight place. I'm not so certain that you would have people being willing to risk that in the coming years. And so actually, you know, beyond the service economy, there is a very broad range of jobs here that probably won't yet be automated by AI.
Oh, certainly not automated, but I wonder how that person who's kneeling down under the toilet will be trained, or how they'll be held to account, or how their work may be supervised in the future. That's where I'm going there. Chris, it's always great to talk to you. I would have loved to also pick up on the themes of, I was going to say cryptocurrency, but I meant cybersecurity, which we should always associate, of course, with AI and lots more. But we'll have to leave that for next time. Thank you indeed very much for joining me, technology journalist and author Chris Stokel-Walker.
Thank you.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, the Texas town built by Elon Musk. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, for my trivia this week. I was in a city in the past few days that was called Waterloo until 1839. This city is the only one in the world that still operates a system of 19th century moonlight towers. And it has the largest natural swimming pool in any US city. I actually give you a little bit of an extra clue there now. Have a think, and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, while we may have been watching the rise and fall of SpaceX share price in recent weeks, there is a town in Texas which is becoming a physical manifestation of the company itself. Joining me to discuss this is Stephanie Finley, the Houston correspondent for the Financial Times, who has recently been to Starbase. So first off, Stephanie, tell us about the six-hour journey towards the city, or the town, I should say. What was that like?
Hi. Well, it's actually quite scenic. It's pretty smooth as drives go. But then suddenly you get, you take a left turn and then you're heading towards the beach and you're on this very small highway. And then you're kind of in scrubland. You're maybe seeing some border vehicles. And then you hit Starbase. It sort of appears on the horizon. And it looks like different manufacturing facilities. You can see the launch towers, and you can see rows and rows of Tesla's Cybertrucks.
And in 2021, Elon Musk tweeted to tell supporters to move to Starbase. So what did he say then, and what effect did it have?
He said, come to Brownsville, actually. He said, we're hiring. And overnight, real estate agents said that they had calls from all over America. And it was not necessarily people wanting to work at SpaceX. I mean, not everybody is a rocket scientist, but they just want to be part of Musk's vision to create this interplanetary human species.
But was there also the knock-on effects of the economic development of that as well? I mean, if you've got more people, you've got more people who want to drink coffee and eat out at restaurants and live there and so on like that. Do you think it was all with a view to being part of the vision, or was there an economic opportunity seen by many?
I think it was mixed. So I think a lot of people came, you know, shortly after there was the pandemic. So that sort of cooled things. But then since then, there has been this absolute boom in the area. And it's not only from the incredible construction happening at Starbase, but they're also building massive LNG facilities in the area. And there's also a massive buildup at the border, which is changing relations between U.S. and Mexico. So in this particular site, which is at the southernmost tip of Texas, there are these huge forces taking place.
I thought it was interesting in your piece that you wrote about in the Financial Times this week after your visit. You said Starbase is a new symbol of Donald Trump's America. You've touched on a couple of points there, but will you elaborate a little bit more about that?
I think, you know, with Donald Trump's America's First priorities, it's pro-business, it's deregulation. I mean, when Elon Musk was choosing this site, There's no doubt that Texas's pro-business approach was one factor. I mean, the state changed the constitution so that they could do rocket launches on the beach. So I think in Texas, Musk has found a place where he can rapidly move and kind of execute what he wants to do with the company. And I think that's the same with the energy buildup that we're seeing there. I mean, Trump has made no secret of his ambition to have U.S. energy dominance and export freedom molecules. I mean, this facility will be one of the largest LNG export facilities in the world. And then at the same time, you also see the intensified security ramp up at the border, where they, you know, there is Brownsville and then there's its sister city, Matamoros, just next door. People used to walk over the bridge, you know, go over there for weekends and party. Now there's the wall. They are installing buoys in the Rio Grande River. There's checkpoints on the bridge. I mean, this is a very different place than it was two decades ago.
If we go back, first of all, to LNG and what you were saying there about freedom molecules, I mean, that's not a technical term. That's a marketing term, we could say, that is being branded on fossil fuels in the US. So when we look at energy hegemony, we look at where or who has got the most dominance in the world in terms of energy. The US seems to be really growing its emphasis for sure on fossil fuels. But then do you think, does that then expose them when it comes to, let's say, a dramatic price fall?
Perhaps. I mean, one thing about the shale revolution in the US, though, is that it has not only produced incredible amounts of oil, but it has this natural byproduct of gas. So the US has these incredible ample gas reserves, which it's trying to capitalize on. And at the same time, you know, Texas is known for producing oil, but it's also one of the largest renewables bases in the US. And as I was driving to the Starbase city, I passed through massive wind farms. So the this push in Texas, this drive also has resulted in increased renewables as well. So I don't think it's necessarily exposing them because they're building up all sorts of different energy.
So there's an energy diversification there of sorts.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. In the piece as well, you say that the Starbase now has a mix of big tech, geopolitical ambition and fortress mentality. And it's clear to hear where the big tech is coming from, namely SpaceX itself, the fortress mentality by virtue of the scale of the construction that you've mentioned. Where do you see evidence of the geopolitical ambition, Stephanie?
I think it's this sense that the US wants to assert itself strongly, that it is making no apologies for its policies, that it is more aggressive when it comes to asserting its resources and asserting its borders.
And what is the vibe like at the border? You mentioned there about, you know, the wall being there now. What is it like? What's the feeling on the ground?
It's heavily built up. It's heavily militarized. You approach it and there's this bridge and you see the walls on either side. You see all sorts of military and checkpoints. And just recently they've installed a new checkpoint halfway across the bridge. And this is designed to stop people from coming over and claiming asylum. So basically any asylum loophole is quickly being closed. And of course, installing the buoys is yet another example of how they are stepping up enforcement at the border.
And if that's obviously from the south, if we look at who is moving there, because I would imagine a city like this is expanding at pace, given the respective pace of construction, etc. Can you describe who is coming there? Is it people who are interested in construction? Is it younger people? Is it older people? Is it people with families? Who are you seeing being drawn to this?
So this was a point of kind of tension in the story, because obviously SpaceX is attracting the most qualified engineers, workers from across the country, but many of them are coming from California. So you have this one class of workers coming to work for SpaceX. Then you have, you know, droves of construction companies working. And then you have auxiliary services. So in Brownsville, there's some more, you know, upscale restaurants that you maybe wouldn't have seen before. There's a hot dog stand called Space Dogs. There's a bar, Pluton Brewing. So you are sort of seeing this mix of people being attracted. However, the one caveat to that is that Brownsville was the site of a series of aggressive ICE raids recently, so immigration enforcement, and construction has actually slowed in the area because of that. People who are trying to build houses on Starbase and in the surrounding area report that they're having to tell people just to wait a while because the workers, which were there illegally, have caused a shortage now after the raids.
Have you seen any evidence of growing pains, maybe when it comes to integration of people or maybe the infrastructure being able to keep up? Any sign of that, Stephanie?
Not that I could see, although I see in recent reports that apparently the electricity has flickered lately. But other than that, it's just incredible how quickly everything is expanding. I've never seen so much construction in such a concentrated area. I mean, the LNG facility had 20 cranes alone that I could count from the highway. I mean, it's just incredibly huge.
And I'm wondering as well about the way in which I'm listening to you describe it. A lot of this, of course, is from your first person experience. As I mentioned at the top, you've been there. But how easy was it for you to talk to people on the ground about their own experience of living there in this immense expansion?
I think it was just, you know, there's some winners and there's some losers. Obviously, the real estate agents were quite happy. Other business owners say that they haven't seen an increase in business. And then other community activists, for example, were saying how it's kind of changing the community for the worst and that Starbase is pushing out local residents and closing off access to the beach. When it comes to actually talking to SpaceX, it's quite difficult. They're all under non-disclosure agreements. This is workers and contractors who are with SpaceX were very reluctant to even say that they were working with SpaceX for fear that they would lose their jobs. So in that sense, there was a large amount of secrecy around what's going on.
You know, as I'm listening to you, it sounds like the pace and scale of a place like Dubai on a beach, only this time it's happening in America. Thank you very much for sharing your experience with us in a part of Texas, which, as you say, is representative not just of a company, but of Donald Trump's America as well. It's been very insightful to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us here on Taking Stock. Stephanie Finley, the Houston correspondent for the Financial Times.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk. Up next, we have one of the most interesting economists you're ever likely to meet. He talks to me about beating inflation. Now, we've seen lots of developments in the news this week relating to changing prices. For a start, we saw euro area inflation reported to have fallen by 2.8%, which was more than expected, actually. And then Bloomberg reported that Kevin Warsh has tapped former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King to co-chair the US Central Bank's new task force on communications. So let's dive into all things inflation and take a look at what's going on around the world with political economist Mark Blythe, who has also co-authored Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers, one of his several books. So first off, Mark, I picked out this quote from the book. Tightening the belt of those whose pants are already tight is what you refer to interest rate increases as. But Kevin Warsh says that inflation is a choice. Please discuss.
I have no idea what Kevin means by that inflation is a choice. If he means that if you're at the bottom half of the American income distribution or the Irish income distribution and prices go up by 5%, the choice is do you put food on the table or you don't. So I literally have no idea what he's talking about in that regard.
I watched the interview where he said it, and he said that central banks have the ability to set price levels at whatever they choose. We may not like the tools or indeed the method of how they do that, but they can.
Well, they can in the sense that what they can do is make things more expensive. But the point I was making is if you're in the top 20% of the income distribution and you shop at, let's say, Waitrose, you got plenty of cash and prices go up 5%, you barely notice it. Interest rates go up, you might notice it a little bit more. You're at the bottom 20%, you absolutely notice this. So this is a very kind of asymmetric way of dealing with this. We have this notion that we all suffer from inflation, but the point of the book is to show that we don't suffer from it equally. So when we raise interest rates, what we're basically doing is punishing people who have got debt and rewarding people who are lenders.
Now, if we just look at the way in which you've said there about we don't all experience inflation equally, I got this from Bloomberg Economics before coming on air. Cumulative inflation for the lowest income decile in the US was about 4.8%, but for the highest income decile, it's 3.8% since the second term of Trump's presidency in the US. Is that driven primarily due to the cost of energy?
Cost of energy is part of it, because the big spike in energy we've recently seen, obviously, is 40% of what we've seen in the past few months. But the bigger one is, when we measure inflation, what we're actually measuring is the cost of things we consume. So here's a simple distinction. If you own a house, it doesn't count as inflation because you don't eat your house. If you're in the bottom 20% and you're a renter, that actually counts into the inflation basket. And also, you spend much more of your day-to-day income on things that you consume. So that's why these guys are feeling 25% more than the people at the top. It's all about what you consume. And if things that you consume are going up and you consume more of them, it's going to hit you more.
Well, I want to stick with housing for a moment. And when we look at the way in which house prices have grown over the past 40 or 50 years, it's also important that we look at how the proportion of people with a second income has grown as well. So if we point out that housing prices today are a multiple of how much the income of a household earns, as distinct to how much a person earns, but then in comparison, we hear a lot of people who are on their own saying, well, how do I get a house, and compare against such high prices? So how do we take a factor that has been successful in many economies, which is to get more women into the workplace, and yet also contend with the fact that there's a lot of people who are saying the ability for them to get housing at all is a big challenge as a result?
Well, both of those things are simultaneously true. Another way of looking at it is that prices in general have gone up so much for goods such as houses that you need two incomes in order to get that good. So rather than this being a cause of celebration, we could actually say, well, in actual fact, we're both working twice as hard for almost half as much money in real terms, because it takes twice as much to buy that house in the first place. The only solution to the housing crisis that's global is we basically stopped building houses for normal people back in 1980. We privatized whatever public housing stock we had, and we left it to the private sector. The private sector will build for the top 30%, because that's where the money is. So there's no solution in this. All you get is turning housing into an asset class, and you need two, if not three, incomes now to get one.
Well, I mean, I would imagine that the third income there is the bank of mum and dad, more so when it comes to the intergenerational wealth transfer. But I do want to explore with you then. So if we want to keep as many people as we have in the workplace, so that aim of full employment, let's say that that becomes more realised as time goes on. How do we address this then? Is your suggestion more public housing?
Yeah, that's the only way to do it. If supply is constricted and there's infinite demand, the price is going to go through the roof. And if you then turn these things into ATMs, if you turn them into cash machines, as they rise in value, you can take out equity against the house and use that for consumption, then you're just going to have a one-way train in house prices. And that's what we've seen globally in global cities over the past 30 years. So unless you start building massive amounts of public housing, you're just not going to get anywhere with this.
Okay, but if we were to build massive amounts of public housing, where is the money supposed to come from? I mean, isn't that then up against, let's say, social welfare or any of the other priorities, including climate change, etc.?
Well, yeah, but we forget that by, you know, spending money on someone's cancer care is a net cost. Spending money on defence is a net cost. If the government builds a house and it borrows at 4 and then it rents it out to people at 6, it makes 2. Also, these are assets rather than costs. You keep them on the state's balance sheet, you're actually improving the state's balance sheet by putting assets on it rather than liabilities. So if you have assets that earn income and it's on the state's balance sheet and you can borrow cheaper than you can rent it out, why would you not do that? You're making money and reducing debt.
Well, the premise of that argument, though, depends upon the fact that the ability of people who are renting are able to rent at that 6 in comparison to the 4.
Right, exactly. But you don't have to then build exactly to the standards you do for multi-million dollar McMansions. There are plenty of ways of doing public housing in Scandinavia whereby normal people and normal incomes are able to afford these things. You don't have to build in the crazy way that we do that basically shoots prices up. And we could also work over the long term to work on the supply chains for everything from drywall to heating, etc. We could do much, much better on public heating infrastructure. There's lots of things that could be done. It's just that the focus isn't there.
You've referred to normal people there now twice at this point. What's your definition of a normal person?
Somebody who's smack bang in the middle of the income distribution who earns exactly the average wage.
Who is that, Mark?
Nobody. That's the problem. We live in incredibly skewed times. That basically in the United States where I live, the top 1% have 50% of all shares. That basically the wealth in the country is 80% controlled by the top 20%. So the vast majority of people are not normal. They wish they could get to normal, and that's part of the problem.
Okay, so if it is the case that public housing would deal with the issue that I brought up there earlier, which is it would make housing more accessible to others, and you also mentioned that there were other knock-on effects as well, whether it's infrastructure, etc. Let's also bring it back, though, to the essence of the book, which is about inflation, which one, as you defined, as the general level of how prices increase. How then do we still address the issue of affordability? And I'm particularly asking you that in the context of the midterms happening later on this year.
It's very, very difficult. I mean, we're now in a world that we haven't inhabited for about 30 to 40 years. For the past 30 to 40 years, whether it was good central bank policy, I'm skeptical on that one, or whether it was China and Eastern Europe joining the global labor market and adding 600 million workers and pushing down prices and wages, whether it was technology, the inventor of containerization on ships, the IT revolution, prices went down and down and down. And all the factors that made that happen have now gone into reverse. So we're looking at structurally higher prices, plus adding the effects of climate change on food supplies, which we're already just beginning to see. And what we're going to have is higher prices going forward. No government has a good answer to this because of what we just talked about, which is basically it's so skewed. If you're in the top 20%, you don't care. You're cushioned against all this. You're in the bottom 20 or 40%. This hits you every day. And basically, we've allowed the world to become so unequal. This is when the payback comes for allowing that inequality.
And who do you think will be blamed for that?
Whoever happens to be in power, regardless of who they are.
So I'm projecting forward what you think then it could be a crushing blow for the Republicans later on this year. Is that what I'm interpreting?
Well, they're certainly going to get a bloodied nose over the critical fallout over AI data centres, the fact that it's pushing up electricity bills 20% in some states, the fact that the Republican Party is completely in hock to half a dozen men whose basic policy seems to be to make half the country unemployed. So, yeah, that would definitely hurt them, and that's part of the cost of living issue. But at the same time, the Republican base is solid. I mean, Trump has often said many times that he could walk up and shoot one of his supporters and he'd get thanked for it. So we're about to test that and see how strong that claim is.
Well, you've started answering my question, but there's a phrase that you say in the book. It's around about chapter two. You say the inflation game is a game whose rules are hidden to the many for the advantage of the few. What are the rules that are hidden, Mark?
Rules are hidden that basically we tell ourselves the story all the time that we all get equally suffer from inflation. And as we've been saying in our conversation, this simply isn't true. If you're in the top 10%, top 20%, you have assets. If interest rates go up, you get paid for inflation. If you're Saudi Arabia and oil prices go on a tear, you get so rich you get to buy Cristiano Ronaldo and all of his friends and set up a pointless football league. Right? So if you're at the top and you have assets, this stuff is actually not toxic for you. If you're at the bottom, if you're a single mom working two jobs trying to hold it together and prices go up by 5%, and then the president turns around and says, I don't really think about these things, I don't care about these things, then you know where you stand and who gets hit.
Right. Let me loop back then to where I started off, which is Kevin Warsh. And indeed, I could extend this to Christine Lagarde or I could go on and on. Interest rates effectively suppress demand. They suppress the ability of people to be able to spend because the cost of the borrowing increases. And many of today's issues, though, are supply shocks, whether it might be the cost of energy or the cost of food. These are down to supply shocks. So if we can't cut the price of energy through increasing the cost of borrowing, what tools can be used then? And Mark, I'm asking you this in the context of a central bank as distinct to the budget policy of a fiscal government.
Yeah. Well, the central bank really has two tools, as you say. The first one is buy and sell assets, which is what you do when you basically can't raise interest rates. That was the past 10 years. And then you raise interest rates when you try to tame inflation. This works on the idea that inflation is, as Milton Friedman famously said, always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Too much money chasing too few goods, so you basically have to make the price of money more so that people's demand for money falls. If it's a supply shock, traditionally central banks do what they call looking through supply shocks. You don't want to think this is an inflation. This is just a temporary bump in the road. But if you keep hitting a road where there's nothing but bumps and your only tool is interest rates, it's not clear that raising interest rates have got anything to do with Europe losing access to, for example, Russian gas.
And Christine Lagarde has said that. She has, not specifically that example, but she has said increasing interest rates in Europe doesn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
Strait of Hormuz.
Okay.
She's right.
Okay, fair enough. So if you were advising her, what would you say then would actually be effective?
Then what she should do is basically go back to the governments and say, look, I know that we told you guys for the past 30 years that you can't do anything, shouldn't do anything, and you're bad at things, and we should leave it all to the central bank. But we're now in a world where that doesn't work anymore. So if you want to help that bottom 20% and that mom that's working two jobs in this inflationary crisis, you need to start designing policies like subsidizing their transport costs, doing something about different tariffs so that people with more money pay a higher tariff for their electricity. You could do things like subsidizing food consumption. You could expand welfare programs at the bottom for the most vulnerable. But you've got to do it on the fiscal side. It can't come out of the central bank. We've got two tools and they're both useless.
And therefore is the problem. Christine Lagarde can't do any of that because that's fiscal policy and outside of her gift.
Exactly. But not just that. We set the whole thing up 30 years ago. The only thing that matters is monetary policy. Let the wizards in the castle set the interest rate. The economy will follow and we'll live in nirvana. Well, we managed to confuse that with what was actually happening, which was an unusual period of deflation in the global economy where prices kept falling and we felt richer because of it. We're now no longer in that world, but we're stuck with the same architecture.
Well, I'm dramatising now for effect, but are you basically saying then we should eradicate central banks and the monetary policy that goes with them?
No, I'm simply saying that it's not the tool for the moment. It's a fine institution and a fine tool if you happen to have something that you can apply the tool to. Just because you've got a hammer doesn't mean everything's a nail.
Right. Well, I also want to just move out of the environments that we've been talking about now geographically, and I need to look at the Global South with you because we have spent an inordinate amount of time looking at the US stock market and particularly looking at the IPOs that are happening or are about to. And I'm wondering whether, as a result of looking at some of the things you've been talking about recently, Mark, you feel that we're missing the point by doing so.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, my favourite example of this is, you know, I'm sitting in France right now and it's coming up for the third heat wave of the summer and we've just started July. Europe is baking every year. The notion that climate change is some kind of hoax has become a sick joke. So if you want to do something about this, where do you go? You go to China and you got all the green tech, you get the wind, you get the batteries, you get the solar, the whole lot. And this is already happening all over the global south. In Pakistan, 20% of their electricity now runs off the grid because Europe nicked their gas in 22 and 23 by buying the spot market from Qatar. They ran out of gas to run their grid. Bunch of Pakistanis basically went over the border, came back with a couple of million panels, assembled it, and now 20% of their electricity is carbon free. You run this across the global south, and what do they not need? They don't need oil. Once they don't need oil, they don't need dollars. Once they don't need dollars, their current account constraint is a lot easier and they can buy and finance things on their own a lot better. We're transforming the global south through this moment of tension, this moment of transformation, and we're not even noticing it because we're focused on the Mag 7 and what Trump did this week.
Okay, but if we go further than that, because you're referring there to the Global South as an entity in itself and how it interacts with the West, but what about the intra-trade that is happening between the Global South? Are we paying enough attention to that?
No, I mean, again, I'll give an example. Folks, if they're listening, can go to the Johns Hopkins Climate Lab and look up the data on this. There's a research study that they did recently that basically shows that Chinese hard FDI, that is putting factories on the ground, making things in different countries, in Malaysia and in Indonesia and Vietnam, over the past several years has been of the scale of the Marshall Plan in World War II. There's huge projects that are going on in the Global South, like the ASEAN Interconnector Project and a whole bunch of other things, which are all about putting down renewable power sources at a scale that Europe can barely imagine. I mean, every year China adopts in renewables the equivalent of the French electricity system into its stack. I mean, there's stuff going on that's transformative in a way we can't understand, and we're not paying any attention to it because we care about Mag 7, AI, and Trump.
Well, Mark, we'll certainly be back to delve into all of those an awful lot more. Thank you very much indeed for joining me. And as I mentioned, Mark is also the co-author of the book Inflation, A Guide for Users and Losers. Thanks so much for joining us here on Taking Stock.
Always a pleasure.
Now, for my trivia this week, earlier on, I gave you three clues. I was in a city a couple of days ago that was called Waterloo until 1839. It's the only city in the world that still operates a system of 19th century moonlight towers, and it is the largest natural swimming pool in any US city. The answer is, drumroll, Austin, Texas. I was over there visiting my in-law cousins, Kevin and Denise, in that most fabulous part of the world. And if you haven't been, put it on your bucket list. In fact, we've actually had a bit of a Texas theme on the show today. Now, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And of course, please do pop the link into your WhatsApp group chats if you know of anybody interested in taking stock of what's going on in the world. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks a million for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day, and already I look forward to talking to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.